good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and however you are listening to this episode of Leadership Bites. It's absolutely fabulous to have you here. So, who do we have today? I have got Jack Zenger. Now, Jack Zenger is, well, we say best-selling author, but he's actually the author of 13 books, which just absolutely shows you the depth of his expertise and insight in the space and place of leadership. He's a best-selling author, he's a speaker, he's a columnist for Forbes and Harvard Business Review. He's got 5 decades of experience, and he really is considered to be a world expert in the field of leadership. He's written books such as How to Be Exceptional, Drive Leadership Success by Magnifying Your Strengths, The Extraordinary Leader, Turning Good Managers into Great Leaders, The Inspiring Leader, Unlocking the Secrets of How Extraordinary Leaders Motivate, along with his newest book, which was released in 2016, Speed, How Leaders Accelerate Successful Execution. I mean, it's a list of excellence. I was beyond thrilled to get Jack on this episode of the podcast. And well, without any further ado, enjoy the episode. Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com. And when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. So, Jack, it's absolutely a privilege to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. I've done a little intro, which will give people a bit of a line of sight on you, but I think it would be marvelous just to hear in your own words who Jack Zenger is and just in essence the field that you play in and where you put your energy and what it is that you think about.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the first thing that people may want to know about me, those who don't have any idea, is that I'm not exactly a spring chicken. I will, in a few days here, I will turn 89 years of age. So,
wow.
One of the things about me that maybe is useful to understand is that I have spent probably 60 years of my life in this general area of thinking about leadership and leadership development. Now, I've done that from 3 different perspectives. I've done it from the perspective of an academic. I taught for a few years at USC. That's the University of Southern California here in the States. At Stanford, I was an adjunct professor in the School of Business. So I was an academic, and then I went on to kind of work in the corporate world. So I, for 11 years, was on the inside of an organization as the VP of Human Resources. And then I decided to launch out and become an external consultant supplier to the industry. But in all of these cases, the common thread was my profound interest in the topic of leadership. I was always fascinated. As a young boy, I'd grown up working alongside my father, who was a hospital administrator. And I quickly kind of could see what a high amount of leverage a person who was in a senior leadership position could have for doing good and for making positive changes in an organization. So my career has spanned these 3 arenas of entrepreneur, academic, corporate, but always with this common thread of leadership. I'm not sure where this all came from, but I certainly think I was blessed with an optimistic point of view. I always believe that the best lies ahead of me. And strangely enough, I still think the best lies ahead of me, which I know sounds strange to lots of people. But I think there's just some exciting things that are going on today. And I believe that, you know, with all of the turmoil going on right now at this moment with the pandemic and the, you know, 1 million people who have died as the consequence, I'm still extremely optimistic about what the future holds for our profession, what it holds for organizations, what we can accomplish. I think we've had some things happen, certainly here on this side of the pond, that have caused a greater awareness of social justice. And I believe that we will painstakingly make some progress in that arena. I think we've made some real, you know, progress in terms of realizing and revisiting the importance of better work-life balance and having people be able to be at home and do so in a highly productive way. So I'm excited about the fact that maybe business travel will not be quite as prevalent as it has in the past. We'll be able to kind of manage that better through the use of technology. And just as you and I today are talking, you know, in a very efficient way, it didn't take one of us getting on an airplane and going for days, you know, and wear and tear on the family and on time and on body and soul to make all this happen. So I'm very much a believer that people have a huge potential, which isn't always tapped, and that when you treat people with kind of great respect and dignity, and you seek out from them what their thinking and their ideas are, that there's just almost an unlimited amount of potential that can be expressed. And so we see these moments in time when people rise to such extraordinary heights and do such marvelous things. And it's when leaders create for them this, you know, this kind of environment where they can be unleashed and the cap can be taken off the bottle, and they can have such positive impact on the world about them. So, you know, that's really at the heart of what I've been doing. My interests over the years have ranged kind of broadly from, you know, self-managing work teams to productivity improvement. But it's always come back to this common thread of what is it that we can help leaders understand about themselves? How is it that we can give them better self-awareness? How can we help them look at their own behavior? How can we help them improve that behavior in positive ways? And I guess the other thing that's really, I think, been a bedrock of what I've tried to do and be is to always emphasize good science, that this thing that we're engaged in is really important, and there is some good science around it. And if we can keep coming back to what's the evidence, what are the research underpinnings of whatever practice we're espousing. So much of what has happened in the past in this general field of leadership development has been very, you know, someone's personal opinions, the latest book that they wrote, but it wasn't always based on any solid evidence. And I think one of the things that I've tried to do in these last years of my career is to have a much more rigorous, objective, analytical look at, so what does the data really say about what truly pays off, what makes a difference in leadership effectiveness? So that tells you a little bit about me.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a feast of things there for me, Jack. So thank you. Thank you for that. I guess because you brought up that span that you've been in this space, and it really struck me, a conversation I had with somebody a couple of years ago, and he was a gentleman who said, I've come to the conclusion that I rob people of their experiences. And you know, that kind of, it sounded very insightful, but I didn't quite get it. And I said, what do you mean when you say that? And he said, well, back in the day when I started in leadership, Guy, and he was a more mature man than myself, he said, we didn't have the internet and it wasn't digital. And when something went wrong, you had a week to put it right, more or less, because you had to write a report or ring somebody up and you could kind of delay things. And then when you did speak to somebody, generally speaking, you'd already put it right. And that was kind of the way of things. He said, but these days, of course, people know about 3.5 minutes after it's gone wrong and you're on the phone on a Zoom call or whatever it is. And that means, he said, I recognize that I've started to micromanage people more. not because my understanding of leadership has changed, but the pressure on me has changed. Mm. And that led me to want to ask you a question, which is, in this time that you've had in this space, do you think the truth of leadership, the inherent truth of what it is to lead somebody or a team or an organization, has changed? Or is it, no, it's really just the context that people are operating in, Guy? You know, lack of less forgiveness, less time. And I just, you know, that may not be the best question I've ever asked, but it's, hopefully you get the essence of what I'm trying to ask you.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, I do believe that we are circling, you know, around about the flame, and that we're getting closer and closer to having an accurate and a practical understanding of what leadership truly is. So one of the advantages of you know, 60 years doing this work in general, I've seen this enormous transformation from a fascination and a focus on command and control, being better at directing, and instead kind of a much greater focus and emphasis on treating people with dignity and respect, and realizing that there is, that the best answers is, as a rule, kind of lie within the person themselves, that my work within individuals isn't me kind of injecting some brilliant new knowledge in them, but it really is in helping them to find within themselves the good answers, and on occasion suggesting some things that they might want to consider that gives them a new point of view, a new frame of reference. But I think we have made real progress in terms of what constitutes truly effective, authentic leadership, and how we can help more people acquire that. And so, yes, I think that the pace of today's world has, you know, put the pressure on leaders to both gather better information, and but it's also put the pressure on them to practice good leadership principles and put into practice some things that we've known for a long time but we haven't always done, and that's what I think is really encouraging about what's happening today, is that we are putting into practice ideas, concepts, principles that were popular 50 years ago, but were popular in terms of the theoretical press, but not practiced.
Okay. So am I hearing from you that you have a sense that the times that we're operating in, you know, the phrase, if you keep on doing what you've always done, you get what you've always got. So there is a recognition that things have to be done differently.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Because I sometimes wonder if, I mean, intellectually, I think that completely makes sense, but I just wonder how that will fare against people's fear of failure, or whether or not the intellectualization of this is the right thing to do. I know it's the right thing to do, but I'm scared because this is a complex situation. But I do know if I just crack on, I'll get something done. And I just wonder how you kind of see that.
Well, let me just circle back a little bit. And that is to say, I'm not suggesting that everything that has been being done in the past needs to be done differently in the future. I think we've had very solid, sound leaders who have practiced some wonderful, you know, principles of leadership in times past. And I think they need to stay. They need to be perpetuated. What we also have seen, though, is there's been a lot of things that weren't done as effectively as they could be. So I just think it's that constant quest for looking for the better way, looking for the more efficient, the more effective, the more respectful way of dealing with people. And I think we have made real progress in that arena. And I hope we can continue to accelerate that progress.
Is there, I mean, I'm looking, you know, whenever I see that somebody's written or co-authored 13 books, it always makes me realize that I'm watching too much television. So that's I've only got the one. So I always think about that. But when I look at 13 books, and I definitely am investing in a couple of them, that's for sure, which is, you know, I wonder if there's any, do you have any, when you look back, do you go, that's what I think stands out for me in my academic purview? There are, even though I may have written or spoken about or referenced a lot of things, mm-hmm. the standout ones for me are, because I had Dave Ulrich on the podcast, and he interestingly said, you know, I don't necessarily want to be known for my first idea, which I thought was very good, because, you know, he said, over the years, I've changed my mind, right? Which I thought was brilliant, because he, mm-hmm. you know, he says, but it's in print, so what can you do? You know? So I just wondered if for you there's anything that, yeah, you know, God, I've said a lot of things, right, over the years, but the things I think I stand by the most are, or the ones I'm most connected to are, mm-hmm. it'd be great maybe to get a sense of that from you.
Mm. Well, yeah, I smile because Dave, who was a friend, I mean, I can just hear him saying that, and I think he's absolutely right that we've all said things early in our careers that we kind of wince when we hear them now. I guess what I'm maybe most proud of, and what I think maybe will be the contribution that may last, is that for a long time we had approached leadership development as if it were a very individual affair, that we were trying to help the individual change his or her behavior in ever better ways, and that the focus was very much on the person. I think what's changed in my thinking in the last few years is that you can't divorce the context in which people work. And the organization has a very major role to play in terms of creating the environment where effective leadership can be practiced and more effective leaders can be developed. And so I think recognizing that interplay between the organization and the individual, and what we can do to kind of help organizations realize what they can do, it isn't rocket science, it isn't anything mysterious. But when organizations, you know, when the senior management of organizations shows real interest, gets highly involved, creates the ongoing sustainment processes, when you put all those things together, then you can see, you know, real magic happen. So in the last version of our book called The Extraordinary Leader, we made some major changes. And the major changes in the book were the addition of 6 chapters that had to do with what the organization needs to do in order to make leadership development really work. And if I've left anything behind, it will be that idea. Now, you know, there have been some other things that my colleague Joe Folkman and I have published and written about that may make some contribution to this discipline. We had this interesting aha when we were looking inside our database of some nearly 1.5 million 360-degree feedback instruments, and we came to the discovery, you know, came to understand that for every one of these leadership competencies that we'd been focused on for a long time, there were a handful of other behaviors that went hand in hand with that. So that notion of there being companion behaviors or enabling behaviors or whatever you want to call them, that idea that by doing one, it's like cross-training in athletics. By doing one, you get better at the other. And by helping people understand what those are, you can help leaders have multiple pathways toward improving their leadership effectiveness. So it isn't just one path. It's not just doing one thing that will help you become better at strategic thinking, or better at problem solving, or better at collaboration and teamwork, or better at whatever. But there are multiple ways of doing that, and they differ from individual by individual. I think that idea may also be something that will live on, and I think other people will come to recognize the validity of that approach.
So just for my own understanding and clarity there, what I'm hearing in that interplay of organization with the person, there's, I've just done some work with an organization that focuses on workplaces, and I never really appreciated how, for example, the dynamics of a workspace, let alone the culture, have an impact on the way that people work. I mean, I inherently knew it, but I didn't pay attention until I started working with them as an organization. Then I suddenly went, oh, okay, I really get it. So there's something then I think I'm hearing there that says, just in that kind of, maybe in that kind of metaphor of that, or in that understanding, that these factors play a part in what it is the person has to work with. I mean, I can turn up with a motivation, I can turn up with a personal accountability, but actually this is going to be dampened or damaged or reinforced or enhanced by the environment that I culturally find myself in. Is that what I'm hearing there? You can make a heaven or a hell for me, right?
Absolutely. And right. And I think so. That's what, again, from an organizational standpoint, one of the opportunities we have is to help corporate executives, public sector executives, to understand what they do to create this environment, to create this context for leadership, makes a big dent on how successful overall leadership development efforts will be for that organization. Yeah.
Okay. And when you talked about companion behaviors, were you giving the idea of almost like physically, by doing one kind of exercise, it can help with multiple areas that one might be doing in a sport? Is it that kind of sense of that one behavior shift can actually help you in multiple disciplines as a leader?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
And so what we've seen is that many times we've thought historically that these leadership competencies were very individual, very separate, very distinct from each other. What we see from the research is that no, they're very intertwined. They're hopelessly linked together. And when you get better at one, it does tend to influence the others. But as you then single out any leadership competency that you want to help somebody be improve upon, what you see is that there are some other behaviors that in some cases look pretty obvious, look pretty intuitive, and then there's other cases where it isn't as intuitive. So, for example, one of the things we've learned about strategic thinking is that encouraging leaders to get up out of their offices and go out and talk to customers has a very high correlation with a leader's ability to be good at strategic thinking. So those who get really high marks in their strategic thinking are also the ones that get high marks in terms of their getting up and going out and connecting with customers. So there is that customer relationship makes a difference. And so there are some non-obvious activities or behaviors that seem to have a strong correlation with any one given capability or competency. Another example is, you know, we think when we talk about the importance of leaders being ethical and having high integrity and honesty, what is it about high integrity and honesty? How do you teach that? How do you inject that in people? Well, you know, that's not easy. I mean, and it's not obvious. One of the things we found from our research on that topic was that leaders who are perceived as having high integrity and honesty are those who tend to be more assertive. And you would say to yourself, oh, wait a minute, those are two totally different things. My being assertive is totally different than my being ethical and honest. And yet, if you think about it more and you say, I'm working in an organization, I see some things going on that I don't believe to be appropriate. If I choose to be quiet, say nothing, not respond, am I being ethical and honest? Or is it the person who has the courage to say, I will speak up. I will speak out. I will call my upper management's attention to these practices that are incorrect, even if it means me losing my job. That kind of assertiveness and that kind of behavior seems to be descriptive of the most ethical and honest people, at least as seen through the eyes of their colleagues.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Yes, the intellectualization of my integrity or my ethics are a beautiful thing, but if they don't manifest in the real world, then it's an intellectual exercise, right? So the assertiveness or whatever, or bravery or whatever it might be, but the willingness to hold space on my opinion and to step into harm's way potentially is what turns it from an isolated intervention inside my head into something that adds value to the world. Okay, that's one I'm going to reflect on a little bit more. So I like that. Thank you for that. So, you know, as you know, if I ask you, I when COVID happened to us, I didn't talk about it too much to people because I thought, well, you know, this will be old news on the podcasts, and you know, a couple of weeks from now, you know, people will be going, why were you making such a big deal of it? You know, mental note to self. That's not turned out to be the case. So it almost probably doesn't matter what it is, in the sense of, okay, we've got this virus, but what we have is this, you know, insert sort of title here, but we have this external force that is putting a lot of pressure on, I guess, the never mind society, but yes, society and the economics that go along with that. And I heard a statement from somebody the other day. I won't say the name because it'll get a reaction from people as to whether or not they like them or not. But what they actually said was, you know, if we're not careful, there won't be an economy to come back to. Which I think is very interesting, this interplay between doing the right thing by people, but also, if we're not careful, the damage inherently could be a lot more damaging. And I wonder, in terms of the conversations that you're having about leading in times where the future is, I mean, the future is always unknown, but you can have a bit of a best guess at what it might be. And I just wonder how you're, or what the conversations are that you're having where people are looking to lead into a 12 to 18 month, maybe 2 year period of, I don't really know where this goes. And I just wonder if that's triggering any particular kind of conversations for you.
Well, I believe that the conversations that is triggering, that eliciting, are first of all those of a bit of humility, because there were a lot of people who shared your view that this was going to be a very transitory, very fleeting kind of event, and that turned out not to be the case. I think it has caused leaders in general to become a little more reflective, and I think if it's had any major impact on the people I talk to, it seems to be that leaders have recognized that their behavior is extraordinarily contagious, that their mental attitude really is contagious, and that one of the things that's very much needed in today's world is for there to be some sense of honesty and integrity about that we don't know the answer to all these questions. But in the midst of all that, to still maintain optimism, excitement about the future, and a willingness to kind of pitch in and do your best to make whatever the future world is going to be, to get there as quickly, as smoothly as is possible. And so I see people in similar roles to the one that I have in terms of they're spending a little more time kind of reaching out to people, seeing how they're doing personally. I think that's happening more than it has historically. And I think that recognizing that, again, this balance of work along with family life, I think we've seen how valuable that family context is. And I think it's whether people are, you know, whatever that definition of family is for them. But we've seen some good things happening as a consequence of it. And we'll find our way through this. But
yes. So I guess what I'm hearing there is it's almost as if, you know, you go on courses and you go on workshops and people say, you know, it's the human being and the human doing and, you know, the intellectualization of balancing those two has always been in the leadership development space.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe what this has done has gone, good luck if you don't now bring that into your reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have memories. They are now going to react to not just the what you're asking them to do, but the manner in which you're taking into account the reality that this is bigger than our product or our service.
Yes. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. So there's a call on that. Okay. So that really resonates. So looking forward to the future, just as we kind of maybe kind of bring this conversation to its conclusion, where's your energy? What are you working on, looking at, or yeah, just even what we may be expecting to see from you?
Well, it may sound strange, but one of the things I've really become intrigued with is the overall importance of organizations creating a more open culture in which people are prone to give each other helpful information, share valuable information that could help them to be even more effective. We mm-hmm. often refer to this as feedback, you know, in terms of me giving you feedback, you giving me feedback. And I've become fascinated of late about this topic of feedback, because one of the things that we've seen from our research is that probably one of the most powerful things you can get leaders to do is to ask for feedback from their colleagues. So while their colleagues do appreciate them giving feedback to them periodically, they even appreciate more the leader who asks for feedback. And I've been intrigued about why that is so. Why is it that me seeing my leader asking me about, you know, ideas about his or her behavior and how it could be altered to be even more effective? What is there about that that is so, so powerful? And I think it's because my leader asking me for feedback is a message of his or her respect for me, his or her wanting truly to improve himself or herself. And it changes the culture. So I'm intrigued with the idea that if you want to truly create a culture of feedback, that maybe the most powerful single thing you could do would be to get people to ask for it. Because when people ask for feedback, then it becomes much easier for me to give them ideas and give them information and to make suggestions about a better process or a better approach. I will tell you that I have a belief that for which I don't have any strong evidence, and that belief.
I built a career on that, so let's move on.
That belief is that the very process of asking for feedback from other people does something pretty magical to you, and that is, I think it increases your level of self-confidence. I think it increases just that very act of asking for feedback. It takes a little bit of courage, it has a little bit of risk involved in it. But when you do it, you find out, oh, other people have good ideas. They're willing to share them with me. And by doing that with some frequency, you soon become very open to better ideas. And what we have seen from our research is that the people who do that are the ones who create an environment of continuous improvement, that both for themselves and for the people that they work with, there is this continuous cycle of ever higher and higher performance and productivity. The self-confidence topic is one that's just has fascinated me through much of the 60 years I've been doing this, because I think self-confidence is rooted, you know, is so much the foundation for many of the leadership behaviors that we've always valued and we've espoused. But we've never known quite how to help people gain greater self-confidence. Some people seem to be born with a certain amount of it, and it hasn't been clear, because simply achieving and accomplishing doesn't do that. I mean, simply having higher levels of, you know, items on your resume doesn't give you high levels of self-confidence. So I'm intrigued by this simple act of asking for feedback, but I don't have any good proof of that yet. So if you'd like to kind of join me in my quest to find the answer to that, I would welcome you.
I'm on board. And it rings true with me. There's something about familiarity with my fear. And, you know, unless you're a fundamental sociopath, then, you know, people fear very often getting feedback. And it's interesting to see people reject positive feedback sometimes as much as they reject any other form of feedback.
Yeah.
Which is, again, you know, quite interesting about that
right.
kind of focus. But what I do notice is that working, so I've spent most of my adult life teaching martial arts and coaching in that space. And what's interesting about that is all the best martial artists are great at doing two things. One is putting themselves into a space with where they're training with individuals who are as good as, if not better than they are.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Which by definition leads to learning, pressure, and when I say constant failure, I mean, yes, they have successes, i.e. they won that round or that bout or that sparring session, but they're continually losing, but by their own design, because there's a lesson to be learned there. Right. And they're getting biofeedback, i.e. how does my body respond to this? They're getting intellectual feedback, as in, you know, maybe if you put your arm to the left and to the right. And what you see is the confidence doesn't grow through success. The confidence grows through failure / receiving constant feedback.
Absolutely. I've often said that any progress that I've seen, you know, in myself and in the people I work around, it has come when they deliberately put themselves in a position of being uncomfortable. So you don't grow when you're in total comfort. You grow when you deliberately put yourself up in a place where you can grow and you can learn, you can test yourself.
Hmm. So I'm now just writing the Zenger and Bloom How Leaders Grow book, and I'll be sending it to you this afternoon for your thoughts. And you're laughing as if I'm actually not going to do it. So listen, Jack, you know, these things for me anyway, probably more for me than for you. I can have conversations with somebody such as your good self until you say to me, you know, Guy, we really have to call this to a close. So before you instinctively do that, I just want to say thank you for your time. I reached out to you and, you know, this stranger from afar sent you an email and you brilliantly responded to it and said, you know, hey, why not? So thank you so much for doing that.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Guy.
So on that note, I'm going to bring us to a close. And if you could just stay on the line for 2 moments, just so I can make sure everything's sort of recorded. Not that we'll do it again if it hasn't, but if you could just give me a second. So thanks very much, Jack.
Okay.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course, you can buy my book, Living Brave Leadership, on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.